This is All In. I'm Matt Pelster. Today, we're getting an update on the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. Later in the show, we'll hear a conversation with the president of the Indiana Hospital Association to find out how the state's healthcare system is doing. But first, we wanted to talk about the virus itself and how Indiana and its citizens are responding to it. We're joined by Shandy Dearth, director of undergraduate epidemiology education at the IUPUI Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Shandy, it's great to have you back on the show.
It's great to be back. Thank you for the invitation.
And the state was going to enter its final stage of its reopening plan this weekend, but it has put that on pause for at least 2 weeks. What are your thoughts on that pause? Is it the right thing to do?
Absolutely. I think it's great that the governor and his team and everyone at the State Department of Health have continuously been looking at the data, and they realize that pausing that can, you know, kind of give us some breathing space, especially as we're entering that point where schools will start opening and other things. We need to be very dedicated to looking at the numbers on a regular basis and slowing down when we need to.
So they're calling it phase 4.5 right now. And knowing what you know about what's allowed under phase 4.5, I mean, is it too much? Should we dial it back? What do you think?
I think slowing it down for these 2 weeks to see if how much of a difference that makes, I think that's the right move. Obviously, we're not at the point where we need to shut everything down again right now. So maybe we would just need to dial it back a little bit more. I think, you know, early on back in March when everything kind of closed, it's because we just did not know what we were dealing with. There was still a lot of concern about how it was most often spread. We've learned a lot since March. So I think we have some better knowledge in our pockets going forward. So I think we can do this in small stages if we do need to pull anything back going forward.
I mean, pulling things back would be a bit of a clawback. It would be challenging to do. Looking at what other states have done similarly to dial back, I don't know. Can we learn anything from what other states have done? Have any other states trying to do that made mistakes?
Well, I think what we saw was that a lot of states opened up pretty quickly. And I think that's where Indiana got it right. We took our time. We kind of looked at the lessons learned from other states in our reopening plans. What we're seeing is that those states who opened up very quickly saw their numbers surge very quickly. And so those are the states that are shutting down pretty quickly again as well. So again, I think we need to take that phased approach as we enter the school time, colleges opening, that sort of thing, just to see how each of these little changes makes an impact in the overall community.
So we're paused at phase 4.5 for at least a couple of weeks. I mean, honestly, from your position as an epidemiologist, is it going to be longer than 2 weeks, would you say? Or should it be?
I mean, potentially. And again, right at that 2 week mark is when we're going to have schools start to open. So that'll be interesting to see what kind of impact schools opening could have on some of these other events. I am happy to see that we're, you know, capping capacity at things like bars, some of those things, because if you think about going into a bar, it's often in an enclosed space. You've got a lot of people crowded, that sort of thing. So I think we really need to limit those unnecessary clusters of people being together. You know, we get a lot more out of going to school than we do going into a bar. So that's why it makes more sense to slow down some of the openings of some of those types of places.
And we'll get into a lot more on these details a little bit later. I just wanted to get a general overview. So let's look at the positive tests. And so state officials looked at higher percentages of these positive tests and more hospitalizations as a couple of metrics that convinced them to put this plan on pause. Can you talk about these metrics and how significant each one is?
Yes. Yeah, so some of the things they look at is the percent of positivity. And that's something that we're hearing more in recent weeks. We didn't hear that as often in the beginning back in March and April. And that's because we just did not have as much testing availability. Back then, we were just looking at raw numbers. We were saying we were testing 1,000 people and, you know, 300 were positive, something like that. And I'm just throwing those numbers out in the air. But right now, we're able to test a lot more people. So we're not telling people to just only come get tested if you're very ill, if you need to come into the hospital. We're telling everyone, if you think there's any chance you've been around a case, come get tested. If you think you're sick, come get tested, that sort of thing. It's much more available. So now that total percent positive gives us a good clue of the ongoing transmission in the area. And so that number has started to creep up since the end of June. So that's a key indicator. Another key indicator is the number of people coming into the hospitals with COVID-like symptoms. We're starting to see that tick up a little bit. So again, we want to make sure that we slow things down at the right pace so that we're not putting that surge on the healthcare system that we saw back in March and April.
We are talking to Shandy Durth, Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at the IUPUI Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. And we're getting an update on the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. So as has been discussed ad nauseum, more testing likely equals more cases, but we have the capacity for more testing now. And so we may end up seeing more cases than we would have before. But is there a mathematical equation or an algorithm to determine the rise in cases now when we have the capacity to test more versus earlier when we couldn't so much? Is there a way we can calculate that to see how we're comparing now versus, say, back in April?
Sure. So that's where the number of people coming into the hospital, the number of people being admitted, and the number of people going into ICU and then onto event really makes a difference. So yes, as you said, as we test more people, we expect to find more of it, especially since up to 40% of the people who have tested positive report not having any symptoms. But what we're not seeing are these huge increases in hospital visits, emergency department visits, admissions, ICU admissions, that sort of thing, as we saw back in March. In March, we had such limited testing capability that those numbers went hand in hand. As soon as our case numbers started going up, the hospitalization numbers were going up as well. And they're not quite hand in hand anymore right now because of the testing capabilities. Now, I just need to caution everyone that could potentially change as testing reagents, supplies, that sort of thing comes into higher demand as we're seeing such huge upticks in other states around us.
And I mentioned a little bit ago some metrics where the state is moving in the wrong direction. Can you give us a sense of where we're at right now? How worried are you about us losing the progress that we've made, I guess, in general?
So I think right now we still have time to get control of the situation. Looking at the latest numbers across the state, we're about a 6, 7, 8% positivity rate. It's important to look at that as a moving average just because some days people just get tested more often than others. Sometimes there could be some data issues with that sort of thing. Moving forward, we just need to make sure that we're looking at that positivity rate and that if we see clusters among schools, among universities, as people come back together, we quickly identify those and take action on those. And what we're also seeing, some of the urban areas like Marion County and Indianapolis, they have mandated masks, which is great. It's all we have right now. We don't have a vaccine. We don't have a great treatment yet. So mask use is really helpful for us right now.
And there's a lot to talk about with masks. We will get to that. But is there anything that you think the state isn't looking at closely enough? Maybe an important metric that's being ignored or undervalued?
I think they're looking at this fairly well. And I think they've been pretty good at communicating that to their local health department officials throughout the state, giving them a heads up. Just recently, we were given a warning in public health that there's a concern about some of the testing supplies. So, you know, maybe we can't rely on testing as much as we were hoping to in the coming weeks. So maybe that's where we need to rely on some other basic guidance we will give out to schools, universities, the general public about just quarantining at home for 14 days versus relying on getting that positive test, because that positive test result might take a few days to come back to you now.
And again, schools is another big topic, which we will also get to. So based on what you're seeing right now here and around the country, what advice would you give Governor Holcomb? And he seems to be very open to this kind of advice from the experts. What advice would you give him and his administration as they move forward?
Yes, I was very relieved yesterday to hear him say he was not going to roll out a statewide mandate for mask use. If you look at the data, Michigan, Illinois, Kentucky all have statewide mandates for mask use. Obviously, people often don't stay just within their own county. So just having 4 or 5 counties in Indiana have a mask mandate is not enough. We really need a statewide mask mandate, just as we would with any other kind of public health recommendations, such as, you know, vaccinations or wearing a seatbelt, you know, one of those things. People are just a lot more likely to follow up if you make it a mandate. And I realize people are resistant to change. People haven't been super happy about the mask issue, but people eventually will come around, and I think they'll recognize it's the smart thing to do for their friends and their family.
Well, let's dig into that a little bit. I mean, just in general, and this is such a big question. We're talking a lot about it. We're talking around it. How important is it to wear a mask when you go out? What does it do?
It's critical. So again, it's not going to, you wearing a mask is not going to protect you from breathing something in from someone else. The concept of you wearing a mask in the situation, these cloth masks that you can get anywhere now at any local store, is to stop the virus from leaving your body, going into the air and infecting another person. So again, up to 40% of people can have the virus, not have any kind of symptoms. You might be out in public, might be out at the mall, not realize that you're sick, and potentially be spreading it to other people who might not fare very well with this. You know, we hear some people say, oh, I'm a healthy young adult. If I get it, it would be fine. Well, maybe that's true, but you don't know who you're going to pass it on to. And so that's why we need everyone to wear a mask, because people don't know if they have it often. And it just helps contain the virus. We actually just saw a news story just this past week of someone I believe was working in a salon, and she was positive, and she had seen something like 120 clients over the time that she was positive, but she always wore her mask. Not a single person became ill. And that's a great success story.
Oh, wow. How do the different kinds of masks function differently? Like different as in the fabrics and some of the other things at work?
So I think what we're seeing is the most important thing is that it's just covered. It doesn't have to be extra special material. Obviously, an N95 mask is something that's used in a healthcare hospital setting, and that does protect the person wearing the mask, not just the people around the person wearing the mask. But a cloth mask can do wonders. But I have to caution, the mask has to cover the nose and the mouth. I see a lot of people with it looped around the ears, but below the chin. And that's not doing anything other than, you know, showing people that you own one, but you have to actually use one as well and use it correctly.
We will be back after a quick break. We're getting an update on the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. We are live with an epidemiologist. So if you have questions or comments about the virus and our response to it as a state, send it to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. We'd love to hear your voice in the conversation today. 866-476-3881. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in less than 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're getting an update on the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. We're joined by Shandy Dirth, Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at the IUPUI Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. And we would love your questions and comments. You can send them to us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. Okay, so Shandy Dirth, we've been talking about masks. There's a lot of confusion about masks since this all started back last spring. A lot of people have gotten mixed messaging, even from high-ranking health officials, about how crucial they are. Do you think that this lack of consistent messaging has had a big impact on the public's understanding of what they need to do?
Yes, I can see how that was confusing in the beginning. And I've got to say, even myself as a professor at the school, I clearly remember giving an extra credit assignment where I had recorded a video talking about why we don't need to go out and buy all of the masks right now. We need to save those for the healthcare workers and that sort of thing to give to the students as they were going away to spring break. You know, we learned that they didn't come back from spring break. We went all virtual because everything was shut down. But I clearly remember that guidance, and I can see why it would be confusing. But what we've learned is that, again, the cloth mask will not protect you from breathing in the virus from someone else that much. It does a little bit of effect. But the big thing is it's holding in the virus to anyone who does have the virus so that they're not spreading it out in the air. They're not spreading it to coworkers, to friends and family, that sort of thing. So that's why we've reversed that. And again, the cloth masks are something that you can get anywhere now, any retail store. It's something that you can make on your own with some simple fabric, that sort of thing. Whereas the N95s, the other surgical masks, those sorts of things, we are still conserving for the healthcare workers who use them on a regular basis anyway in the healthcare setting. So that way it's a good balance. We can help protect each other out in the community, and the healthcare workers can be protected inside the hospital settings.
And you can have a little fun with them too. You can pick fun patterns and you can iron on some stuff. That's what we've done in our house. We have a listener voicemail, our first one for the day. This is from Suzanne. You can listen to that now.
Hi, my name is Suzanne Nittenfall, calling from Martinsville, Indiana. Two comments. One, I just heard somebody talking about Indiana's rates of infection. Please comment on the fact that the increase has been focused on the lakeshore recreation areas, the federal and state parks up in northeastern Indiana, not statewide. The other one is school opening. I have grandchildren in Norway. I'm there often. They have opened their elementary schools, as have many in Europe, very successfully because based on the scientific knowledge that young kids don't spread the virus. In my kids' school in Oslo, they limit congregating, they stagger entrances so people are not crammed in halls and such, but no deaths reported anywhere, and they've been open since April. Bye.
Thank you, Suzanne, for that. So, Shandy, let's focus on the first point, and that was the increased infection rate. And she says that it seems concentrated in the northern part of the state. Which, do we know anything about that?
We have had some outbreaks over the summer in some of the like meat packing plants, that sort of thing, in some of the northern counties. We are starting to see an increase in many of the counties that have some of the colleges because the athletes are coming back earlier than the rest of the students. And then some of those other special student groups are coming back now, even though classes don't start for a couple more weeks at many of the universities. So we're already starting to see that very slow uptick. So that leads to some higher numbers across the state as a whole. So she's right. If you look at the ISDH dashboard or the dashboard that Regan Struth Institute has on their webpage as well, we don't have every county in the state lit up as having these huge increases. So if you look at a state average, overall, we are up. Some counties are not up yet, but I will caution that I will not be surprised if we see increases across the state within a few weeks.
The young kids don't spread the virus.
Yes, and we are seeing some studies. I know what she's referencing in Germany. I've seen a few studies that say the kids don't seem to be spreading as much. And then I've seen some other situations where they did see some outbreaks in schools in other countries. So again, that's where we really need to be transparent in how the kids were moved throughout the school, how they were cohorted, that sort of thing. It sounds like the school that she mentioned has some great lessons learned that we should learn from here in the U.S. And I see that in a lot of the school guidance coming down from CDC, from the State Department of Health. I've looked at the guidance from the Marion County Health Department. And so they've done a great job of trying to make sure kids are cohorted. You've got assigned seats. So that way, if we need to do contact tracing, we can more easily identify students. These guides and recommendations and plans are being shared on websites so that parents can access them as well so they can plan ahead. And I just want to warn everyone that going into the school year, as a parent myself, I know I need to be prepared for my kids to be sent home for a couple of weeks at a time if they end up being a contact of a case in their classroom or some other activity. So it's just something that we're going to have to deal with for, you know, this next school year. It's not a pleasant thing to deal with, but at least we know now going into the school year versus March, where it seemed like all of a sudden we were flipping a switch and everyone was home.
Well, so let's talk about schools. We're approaching the end of summer, of course. And have you been watching some of the conversations around reopening schools? What are your thoughts on the approach that some schools say they're going to take? Now, Indiana has left it up to local officials on whether or not schools reopen. What do you think about that fact that some schools don't seem to know what they're going to do yet?
Well, I think it is good that the governor is leaving it up to the individual schools, because again, it's not a one size fits all approach. Obviously, what you can do in some of these larger schools might be different than what you can do in some of the smaller schools as far as spacing out some of the students. Some schools are just typically more crowded on any regular school day. And I like that the schools can be virtual or in person or choose to be a mix of both. I know my school system is being very flexible in how we can handle that with our children. And it's important for parents to look at their own home situation. Is the kid part of a vulnerable population where they've got some health issue where maybe they really shouldn't be around mass quantities of people? Or do they have someone at home that they're concerned about? Perhaps the child could bring that virus back home. So I think it's great that there's some flexibility, and some kids do learn better in a classroom setting. And a lot of kids, need to rely on that school system for some of that social support. So I like that there's some parent choice in this, but again, just be prepared that your kiddo might be home with you for a couple of weeks, maybe more than once as we go through this over the next school year.
We're talking with Shandy Durth, Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at the IUPUI Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. We're getting an update on the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. And right now we're talking about reopening schools. So Shandy, level with me. Is it safe for schools to open their classrooms?
I think if they take the right measures and the right approach, it can be done safer. I'm not going to say everything is 100% safe because we know the virus is still there. The virus has not left. I expect to see some increases in cases as the schools open. And again, there are going to be lessons learned from that. So maybe we need to do a better job at having set entrances and exits, as the caller mentioned earlier. Maybe we need to do more staggered schedules. So the school districts, from what I've seen, have a very wide approach as to how they're dealing with this upcoming school year. So again, I think there are going to be some strengths and some weaknesses. And unfortunately, we just haven't been through this yet. So we still have to learn what those are.
So different states are doing things differently. And some states are using this infection rate data to decide whether schools can start classroom teaching again. Is using that data the right approach?
You know, I heard that New York was following that as well. And I don't know if I don't feel super confident in that. I don't ever think it should just be one number that sets a policy for something like that. I know typically when we deal with influenza every year around Indiana, when the hospitals get together, and your next speaker could probably talk about this as well, they look at not just the number of people coming into the emergency departments with influenza-like illness, but they look at the strain on the healthcare system. They look at a number of other items before they decide to take action, such as restricting visitors to the patient rooms, that sort of thing. So I wouldn't say there's a set number we should follow. I think, again, it's where each school can be allowed to close when they need to close. It should not have to come from a government mandate, but at the same time, it's great that the government mandate does not say you have to stay open, because I don't think that's realistic or a healthy approach either.
So yesterday, this week, Indiana's infection rate, yesterday it was at 7.1%, at least that's the most recent number. So this is over a 7-day average, and that number was reported yesterday. State Health Commissioner Dr. Christina Box said that the state will reconsider their approach to schools, again, talking about this infection rate, if it climbs up to 10 or 15%. What do you think of that as a standard?
I think that's a good goal to look at, but I think they're also aware of issues with testing. We've been warned that testing might be delayed, so we might not be able to rely on that percent positivity rate, that number that I explained earlier. And I know Dr. Box and her team are well aware of that. They're the ones that warned us about the possible disruption in supplies in the coming weeks. So I don't think they will be hard set on that number. I think they'll look at other issues. If they're hearing from superintendents, hearing from hospital settings, that they're seeing huge numbers of cases, that they're having issues, that sort of thing, I think they will give out some renewed guidance to the school settings.
I can't imagine the balancing act that they and other officials have to perform right now. I do not envy their position, for sure. We have another listener voicemail. This one is from Ben. Let's listen.
Hi, my name is Ben, and I am calling from Carmel, Indiana. I'm a college student, and I'm wondering, what is the simplest scientific explanation to tell to my friends and network who don't believe wearing a mask helps in stopping the spread of the virus? What is the simplest way to tell them that it is helpful and that they should be doing it? Thanks.
It's all over social media, isn't it? We can't get away from it. People who don't believe it, people who are trying to convince those who don't that it does work. What do you think works right now, Shandy?
Well, I know I've seen lots of memes and lots of demonstrations and things like that. I think one thing that kind of has stuck in my head in the last couple of weeks is there's a visual of someone out in the cold breathing out, and you see the moisture droplets basically as they're breathing out, kind of freezing in the air, kind of how you can see your own breath here in Indiana in the middle of winter. Well, that shows you how far you can spread a virus like that as well. So that's a good visual that stuck in my head. Again, I think we need to normalize it that it's expected that you wear a mask. You know, over the years, we've kind of normalized it more that it's expected that tobacco use is bad for you and you shouldn't be smoking. I'm sure that wasn't the case in the 60s and 70s among college students. And that has definitely gone down in college students over the years. So I think, like you said, we can make mask use more fun designs, goofy designs, you know, no kind of limit on what kind of design you could have on the mask, that sort of thing. So I think we need to take that approach. And if he can figure out how to get his college friends to wear a mask, I ask that he tell all of us in public health how to do that.
we're looking for your guidance, Ben. Once you figure it out, let us know. So right now, Shandy, a lot of businesses can be partially reopened. We can have 75% capacity at restaurants, 50% capacity at bars, nightclubs, and other entertainment venues. I mean, is it safe at this point to even have that amount of people in an enclosed space?
What I'm telling everyone constantly is that just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And also, it's summer in Indiana. Let's enjoy it. All winter long, we cannot wait for spring and summer to get here. At least I can't, because I'm not a huge fan of winter. So when you go to a restaurant, try and go ahead and sit outside. Indianapolis and a lot of other cities and towns around the state have done a great job of allowing more outdoor dining options. So take advantage of that while you can. You probably don't want to do that in January and February. So take advantage of that. Again, really think twice about heading into any kind of enclosed space if you don't have to be there. And if you are going to go in, wear a mask. And I realize that sounds unrealistic to go into a bar and wear a mask, which tells me to just, you know, go somewhere where you can be outside and have a drink with your friends and family, that sort of thing. And as for other entertainment venues, again, just really think about whether or not you need to go in there. And if you're, if you have any health conditions that you would be concerned about, or if you have someone living in your house with any kind of health conditions, please think twice about doing that, because it might be unnecessary exposure. And you would just feel really bad if you brought the virus back to a loved one who became very ill.
How much of a difference does it make to be outside, even if you're still sitting at tables near other people and talking to waiters?
Outside definitely helps. And that's why you've seen, again, a lot of restaurants move a lot of that seating outside as well. They're also trying to protect their serving staff and restaurant workers. And we also saw, though, still having a mask outside if you're not outside eating really helps. So we didn't see any big outbreaks related to the protest earlier in the summer. And we think it's because so many people were wearing masks. So again, outside helps. But if you're not 6 feet apart from one another, wearing a mask is still the better option.
Okay, so we're talking about some of these risky places like bars where you just can't wear a mask the entire time you're there, as you said. I mean, if someone is going into a place like that, what can they do to be as safe as possible?
I would say be really selective as to which establishment you're going into. So what I've heard is some of the bars and some of the college towns now, they are limiting alcohol service to table only. So you can't go stand at the bar and wait for your drink. So they're trying to protect the bartender. And then they're also trying to protect their customers so that you don't have a bunch of customers standing up, clustered together, that sort of thing. So if you stay at your own table and a server comes to you to deliver your food and drinks, that's just a much better scenario. That way you're not around as many people and you're less likely to transmit. So that's definitely recommend it. And again, be outside if you can.
Rex on Twitter asks, does Indiana include positive antibody tests in their positivity rate, or is the 7.3% number all active cases?
That is a great infection and that or great question. Sorry, and that sounds like he is an infectious disease epidemiologist. So no, that antibody number is not included in that positivity rate because we're trying to look at current infections, so not possible past infections, which is something you may pick up with an antibody test. So they are separated. And if you look at the State Department of Health dashboard, it explains that a little bit.
I feel like we always have to ask this. What do we know about progress being made toward a vaccine?
Well, actually, just Tuesday of this week, Dr. Fauci announced that NIH and Moderna Incorporated have a somewhat maybe a promising vaccine in the works. And so their initial studies of a very small group of people show some promise. And so I believe this week or next week, they are starting a bigger study involving 30,000 people. And that will give us some definitive answers on whether or not we can move forward with mass production of that vaccine. Again, vaccine production is not a quick process. So it would still be a good 6 months out from the time they kind of finished the clinical trials before we would really expect to see vaccine distribution out in the U.S.
Okay. Shandy Dearth is Director of Undergraduate Epidemiology Education at the IUPUI Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health. Shandy, thank you so much for joining us today. Great info.
Thank you.
After the break, we'll talk about how Indiana's healthcare system is faring with the president of the Indiana Hospital Association. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're getting an update on the COVID-19 pandemic in Indiana. So far, we've been talking about what we know about the virus and how the state and its citizens have decided to respond. But now, we want to find out how Indiana's healthcare systems are doing. And to help us through it, we're joined by Brian Tabor, president of the Indiana Hospital Association. Brian, thanks for taking the time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So we'll get into detail here in just a moment, and we'll break down specific categories within the healthcare system. But before we do that, how would you characterize the current state of the industry in Indiana overall and how it's handled the pandemic?
Well, I would have to start by just lauding the work of our healthcare heroes. I am very proud to be associated with the men and women of Indiana's hospitals, the nurses, physicians, administrative staff, the infection control professionals who keeping the facilities clean, not just for COVID patients, but for safe treatment for everyone. And I think it's just been remarkable what they've been able to do to address this public health emergency. So I think it's been a very strong response, but there is certainly strain on the system, not just at the hospital level, but all the way down throughout the healthcare continuum. So I think it's important that as we move forward, we make sure that the resources are there to keep that healthcare safety net strong across the state as we move forward and try to deal with what could be a future resurgence of COVID or perhaps something else.
I want to dig into the strain on the system a little bit later, but we'll back things up a little bit. And can you explain what the association you belong to is, the Indiana Hospital Association? What is it and how much of the industry do you represent?
Yeah, so we are the trade association for Indiana's hospitals and really virtually every hospital in the state is a member of the IHA. So rural hospitals, large health systems, regional or statewide health systems, and not only the hospitals that might conjure up or think immediately of with an emergency room and the blue H sign out front, but also behavioral health hospitals. So those that treat psychiatric conditions across the state, community mental health centers that offer inpatient services, and then other hospitals, rehabilitation hospitals, long-term acute care hospitals. There are some specialty hospitals that are members of IHA. So it really represents just about all kinds of a hospital that exists here in Indiana and virtually everyone from the north to the south.
And the Indiana Hospital Association released new data earlier this week showing how the pandemic has impacted the healthcare system. So we can dig into this a little bit more. What kind of data are you working with and how did you get it?
So there's obviously been a lot of discussion around other numbers, and I know you're talking about those today, or where we are with respect to the state's dashboard on cases and hospitalizations. And we certainly pay a lot of attention to that here at the association as well. We have a great partnership with the Indiana State Department of Health and the Holcomb administration. And, you know, I would also just have to say what a tremendous job that Dr. Chris Box and her colleagues and really everyone on that team has done. It's been a great partnership, and, you know, without their leadership, we would have faced even more challenges as we battle COVID. But, you know, from the press conferences that's a lot of what we're talking about, the data that gets reported, but there's other data underneath. And one of the things that we have to pay attention to here at the association is how are our members doing financially? We advocate, that's a big part of what we do at the association. We advocate at the state and federal level for hospitals and for the patients that they serve. And so we started to take a look at the financial stress that the public health emergency that this pandemic is taking on our members. And it was quite significant in a negative fashion. And so we wanted to share that information. And we've been sharing that with the public, but also with policymakers, because it's been significant, the toll, and without some additional federal relief, we think that strain, you know, could ultimately lead to closures or reduction in service. And that's obviously not what we want to see at this time.
Can you point to one thing or one factor that's had the most significant negative impact on hospitals financially?
Well, and not to give you an answer on one, but it really is, it really is two things. It's two competing, not countervailing, but two forces. One is the increased costs. So hospitals jumped into action here in Indiana and invested in additional ventilators, increasing our capacity and intensive care units to deal with COVID patients. There's a significant amount of resource intensive treatment that's needed for COVID patients. So working again with the partnership with the state, we ramped that up. And at the same time, costs were also going up for supplies. So there's been a lot discussed nationally around the shortages that we had of personal protective equipment or PPE, the masks, the gowns, hand sanitizer, all of those things, and other supplies too, critical drugs. All the prices for all of those things went through the roof, and that market really still hasn't gotten back to normal. So the costs increased. So that was one big pressure point on hospitals. And on the other side, of course, like many businesses, patients have, in many cases, stayed home. Unfortunately, sometimes in ways that may present some risk to their health, but understandably, the concerns about COVID, we had fewer patients coming to the hospital. And I'd like to share, you know, a little bit more about some of those statistics, and I know you've seen them. But then also understanding the shortage of PPE suspended many of the procedures that hospitals perform to save PPE to deal with the COVID surge. So we had costs going up and then revenue declining because of suspending certain procedures, patients being concerned about not coming to the hospital for care that they need. And so both of those things has created quite a crunch.
We're talking to Brian Tabor, president of the Indiana Hospital Association. And there's a list of factors that's listed in this report that we mentioned, and I want to go through a few of them and unpack them. You mentioned rising drug costs. I want to know a little bit more about what that's looked like.
Yeah, so along with other supplies during COVID, the costs of pharmaceutical that hospitals purchase for there. A lot of times when we think about pharmaceutical costs, typically people may think of, you know, over-the-counter costs. And I know that's a whole nother discussion, but the costs of treating patients within the hospital. There's a pharmaceutical cost, one of the most rapidly growing part of a hospital budget. But not only that, it was really everything. So we're looking at, again, the masks, the personal protective equipment, things like inhalers that are, purchased for patients that have respiratory issues. Those were in very scarce supply. Remember, the whole global supply chain was disrupted. A lot of medical products are produced in Asia. And even when they weren't, you just had global commerce disrupted. And so many of these things were just in incredible shortage, or they were misallocated. They were stuck other places. And so that drove the price up. So the drugs, the PPE, all of that meant that, in some cases, hospitals were paying multiples of up to 10 for something that they would have paid before COVID hit. Now, market PPE, hospitals are able to get that now, and we're able to provide care safely, but it is still often at greater expense than before COVID. And I don't see that really getting back to normal for quite some time.
And regarding PPE, I mean, I used to work in a hospital. PPE was everywhere, but these are totally different circumstances right now. When on the issue of PPE and acquiring it and cost, I mean, is it just the fact that everybody needs so much more of it, and so the price is going up and it's harder to acquire? Is that basically the PPE problem?
That's a big part of it, yes. I think that there, in some cases, there was more needed because of COVID, and especially how little we understood about it initially. So you needed a lot of PPE, more on a typical day than you might have needed in a hospital, because we didn't know much about the virus. And even what we do know now tells us that it can be spread very easily. And so we need to use PPE in settings where before COVID, maybe we didn't. We're all wearing masks now. We all should be. So we're using more of the stuff than was even around before COVID. So we're using more of it. But also, like you mentioned, there just wasn't enough to go around. The entire world was in a search for PPE. And so, in some cases, the supply that was starting to return, many Asian countries where it's produced, it was being sent to Italy when they had an outbreak, and we were sort of chasing the next hotspot with a lot of this equipment. And so there wasn't enough to keep up. And so the price just went up, and it skyrocketed. And while it has come back down to earth somewhat, it's still more expensive generally, and not as easy to get as before.
But some of the hospitals taking the biggest hit financially in Indiana are in rural communities. Can you give us a sense for how different the situation has been for those hospitals?
Yes, and many of the rural hospitals in Indiana were hit with kind of a double whammy that they not only have what has already been a long-term trend of financial vulnerability with rural hospitals. COVID coming along really has created a real risk, existential kind of threat to some of our rural hospitals. Fortunately, there's been some federal relief that's been extremely helpful, and we can talk a little bit about that. But yes, what COVID did was come in and layer on top of an already existing vulnerability in our healthcare safety net. Our safety net hospitals in rural communities, and in many cases urban communities, are typically the reimbursement that they get comes from government sources, where government payment, Medicaid or Medicare, pays below the cost of delivering services. And so their budgets are already strained for various reasons. And then the double whammy of paying more for supplies and having a significant reduction in revenue or patient volume has really impacted them.
There was a term that we ran across when we were preparing to talk to you that I had never heard of. What is a critical access hospital?
Yeah. So a critical access hospital is, it's a hospital The name is one of the CAH. It's part of the alphabet soup that you have in healthcare acronyms and government payment. It's a special designation that the federal government came up with to recognize that there are many communities where it's essential. It is critical that we provide access in this area. So as names go, it's actually a pretty good one. I think it says what they really are about, which is they are a vital hub of healthcare in rural communities throughout Indiana. We have 35 of them. And without these critical access hospitals, patients in rural parts of Indiana would have to drive much further for services. And so the government has a slightly different payment mechanism under Medicare for these critical access hospitals. And we found that in the month of April, where COVID was really kind of taken hold here, that the average operating margin, financial operating margin for those hospitals, those critical access hospitals, was almost 30%. So obviously not sustainable. And we really need those critical access hospitals. We need those outposts of healthcare to stay there for the patients that they serve in rural areas. But they're very often the largest employer in a county or maybe a 2 or 3 county region. And they serve as the backbone of the healthcare delivery system. So for purposes of attracting economic development, business will say, what's the healthcare system like? Having a critical access hospital is really important. So we want to see these hospitals, we want to ensure from our perspective, and I think everyone should value this, that they are able to survive and come out the other end of this COVID crisis, that they are able to keep their doors open.
Well, is there relief available for rural hospitals facing financial problems right now?
There has been, and we appreciate Congress, and I want to also give a shout out to our congressional delegation here in Indiana that supported the CARES Act. All of them did. The financial relief that came to hospitals as a part of that was vital. If not for that, we would have seen facilities shutter already at this point in the summer. I mean, when we were back in March and in April, kind of staring into the abyss, it was just going to be really difficult for hospitals to keep it going to this point. So that federal relief has been critical. The federal government, Congress allocated about $150 billion, and about half of that has been distributed. And we are hopeful that the remaining amounts will be distributed fairly soon. And with this, the public health emergency lasting longer than maybe we had all hoped, it's going to be important for Congress to continue to look at the vulnerability of hospitals, and we hope provide additional relief in the not too distant future.
That's going to do it for today's show. Brian Tabor is president of the Indiana Hospital Association. Brian, thank you so much for taking the time.
I really appreciate you reaching out and the opportunity to talk about this topic.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Be sure to subscribe so you always know what we're up to. Tomorrow is our Friday pitch-in, where we get an update on the biggest statewide headlines of the week and dive into a few more stories we think you'll find interesting. We are on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. In the meantime, follow us for topic alerts and discussion. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.